Einstein said, still playing. All the members of the General Assembly session are behind the building, attending the pendulum initiation ceremony. Wong walked around the building and was greeted by a breathtaking sight. A colossal pendulum that seemed to stretch between the sky and the earth. In fact, Wong had seen it peeking out from behind the building, but he didn't know what he was seeing. The pendulum resembled those constructed by Fu Xi to hypnotize the sun god during the Warring States period, back when Wong Miao first logged on to Three Body. But the pendulum before him had been completely modernized. The two pillars holding up the pendulum were made of metal, each as tall as the Eiffel Tower. The weight was also made of metal, streamlined with a smooth, mirror-like, electroplated surface. The pendulum line, made of some ultra-strong material, was so thin as to be almost invisible, and the weight seemed to float in the air between the two towers. Below the pendulum was a crowd of people dressed in suits, probably the leaders of the various countries attending the General Assembly session. They gathered in small cliques and talked amongst themselves quietly, as though waiting for something.
Copernicus, the man who crossed five eras,
someone shouted. The others welcomed him.
You're one of those who saw the pendulums of the Warring States period with your own eyes.
A friendly man shook and held Wong's hand. Someone introduced the man as the Secretary General of the UN from Africa.
Yes, I did see them, Wong said. But why are we building another one now?
It's a monument for Trisolaris, as well as a tombstone.
The Secretary General looked up at the pendulum. From down here, it appeared as big as a submarine.
A tombstone? For who?
For an aspiration, a striving that lasted through almost 200 civilizations, the effort to solve the three-body problem, to find the pattern in the sun's movements.
Is the effort over?
Yes. As of now, it's completely over.
Wong hesitated for a moment before taking out a stack of papers. Wei Cheng's three-body mathematical model.
I came here for this. I brought a mathematical model that solves the three-body problem. I have reason to believe it will likely work.
As soon as Wong said this, the crowd around him lost interest. They returned to their cliques to continue their conversations. He noticed that a few even shook their heads and laughed as they left him. The Secretary General took the document and, without even glancing at it, handed it to a slender man wearing glasses standing next to him.
Out of respect for your famed reputation, I'll have my science advisor take a look. Indeed, everyone here has shown you respect. If anyone else had said what you said, they'd be laughing at him.
The science advisor flipped through the document.
Evolutionary algorithm. Copernicus, you're a genius. Anyone who can come up with such an algorithm is a genius. This requires not only superior math skills, but also imagination. You seem to be suggesting that someone has already created such a mathematical model. Yes, there are dozens of other mathematical models. Of those, more than half are more advanced than yours. They've all been implemented and run on computers. During the past two centuries, such massive computation became the principal activity of this world. Everyone waited for the results, as if waiting for Judgment Day. And? We have definitively proven that the three-body problem has no solution.
Wong gazed up at the massive pendulum overhead. In the dawn light, it was crystal bright. Its deformed, mirror-like surface reflected everything around it like the eye of the world. In this place, in a distant age, separated from the here and now by many civilizations, he and King Wen had passed through a forest of giant pendulums on their way to the palace of King Zhou. Just like that, history had made a long circuit and returned to its starting place. The science advisor said,
It's just like we guessed long ago. The three-body system is a chaotic system. Tiny perturbations can be endlessly amplified. Its patterns of movement, essentially, cannot be mathematically predicted.
Wong felt his scientific knowledge and system of thought become a blur in a single moment. In their place was unprecedented confusion.
If an extremely simple arrangement like the three-body system is unpredictable chaos, how can we have any faith in discovering the laws of the complicated universe?
God is a shameless old gambler. He has abandoned us. The speaker was Einstein, waving his violin. Wong didn't know when he had shown up. The Secretary General slowly nodded.
Yes, God is a gambler. The only hope for Trisolaran civilization is to gamble as well.
By now, the giant moon was rising again from the dark side of the horizon. Its large, silvery image was reflected by the surface of the pendulum weight. The light wriggled strangely, as though the weight and the moon had developed a mysterious sympathy together.
This civilization seems to have developed to a very advanced state, Wong said.
Yes, we've mastered the energy of the atom and reached the information age.
The Secretary General didn't seem to be too impressed by his own words.
Then there is hope. Even if it's impossible to know the pattern of the sun's movements, civilization can continue to develop until it reaches a stage where it can survive the chaotic eras by protecting itself against the devastating catastrophes of those eras.
People once thought as you do. That was one of the motivating forces pushing Trisolaran civilization to tenaciously come back again and again. But the moon made us realize the naivete of such an idea.
The Secretary General pointed to the rising giant moon.
This is probably the first time you've seen this moon. Actually, since it's about a quarter of the size of our planet, it's no longer a moon, but a companion to our world in a double planet system. It resulted from the Great Rip.
The Great Rip?
The disaster that destroyed the last civilization. Compared to the civilizations before it, they had ample warning of the disaster. Based on surviving records, the astronomers of Civilization 191 detected a frozen flying star early on.
Wong's heart clenched as he heard the last phrase. A frozen flying star was a terrible omen for Trisolaris. When a flying star, or a distant sun, seems to come to a complete stop against the background star field, then the sun's and the planet's motion vectors are aligned. This has three possible interpretations. The sun and the planet are moving in the same direction at the same speed. The sun and the planet are moving apart from each other, and the sun and the planet are moving toward each other. Before Civilization 191, this last possibility was purely theoretical, a disaster that had never occurred. But the population's fear of it and their vigilance did not diminish, so much so that frozen flying star became an extremely unlucky phrase in many Trisolaran civilizations. A single flying star remaining still was sufficient to terrify everyone.
And then, three flying stars froze simultaneously. The people of Civilization 191 stood on the ground, gazing up helplessly at the three frozen flying stars, at the three suns falling directly toward their world. A few days later, one of the suns moved to a distance where its outer gaseous layer became visible. In the middle of a tranquil night, the star suddenly turned into a blazing sun. Separated by intervals of 30 hours or so, the other two suns also appeared in quick succession. This was not a normal kind of trisolar day. By the time the last flying star turned into a sun, the first sun had already swept past the planet at extremely close range. Right after that, the other two suns swept past Trisolaris at even closer ranges, well within the planet's Rocher limit, such that the tidal forces imposed on Trisolaris by the three suns exceeded the force of the planet's gravitational self-attraction. The first sun shook the deepest geological structure of the planet. The second sun tore open a great rift in the planet that went straight to the core, and the third sun ripped the planet into two pieces.
The Secretary General pointed at the giant moon overhead.
That's the smaller piece. There are still ruins from Civilization 191 on it, but it's a lifeless world.
It was the most terrible disaster in the entire history of Trisolaris. After the planet was torn apart, the two irregularly shaped pieces each returned to spherical form under self-gravitation. The dense, searing planetary core material gushed to the surface, and the oceans boiled over the lava. The continents drifted over the magma like icebergs. As they collided, the ground became as soft as the ocean. Massive mountain ranges, tens of thousands of meters high, rose in an hour and disappeared just as quickly. For a while, the two ripped-apart pieces were still connected by streams of molten lava that coalesced into a space-spanning river. Then the lava cooled and turned into rings around the planets. But because of perturbations from the planets, the rings were unstable. The rocks that formed them fell back to the surface in a rain of giant stones that lasted several centuries. Can you imagine what kind of hell that was? The ecological destruction caused by this catastrophe was the most severe in all of history. All life on the companion planet went extinct, and the mother planet almost became a lifeless waste as well. But in the end, the seeds of life managed to germinate here, and as the geology of the mother planet settled down, evolution began its tottering steps in new oceans and on new continents, until civilization reappeared for the 192nd time. The entire process took 90 million years. Trisolaris's place in the universe is even more grim than we had imagined. What will happen the next time frozen flying stars occur? Very likely, our planet will not just skim past the edge of the sun, but will plunge into the fiery sea of the sun itself. Given enough time, this possibility will become certainty. This was originally just a frightening speculation, but a recent astronomical discovery has caused us to lose all hope for the fate of Trisolaris. The researchers had intended to recover the history of the formation of the stars and the planets based on signs in this stellar system. Instead, they discovered that in the distant past, the Trisolaran stellar system had 12 planets. Yet, now only this one remains. There is only one explanation. The other 11 planets have all been consumed by the three suns. Our world is nothing more than the sole survivor of a great hunt. The fact that civilization has been reincarnated 192 times is only a kind of luck. Also, after further study, we discovered the phenomenon of breathing by the three stars.
The stars breathe?
It's only a metaphor. You discovered the gaseous outer layer of the suns, but you didn't know that this gaseous layer expands and contracts over cycles lasting eons, like breathing. When the gaseous layer expands, its thickness can grow by more than a dozen times. This greatly increases the diameter of the sun, like a giant mitt that can catch planets more easily. When a planet passes by a sun at close range, it will enter the sun's gaseous layer. Friction will cause it to lose speed, and finally, like a meteor, it will fall into the blazing sea of the sun, dragging a long, fiery tail. The study results show that in the long history of the Trisolaran stellar system, every time the sun's gaseous layers expanded, one or two planets were consumed. The other 11 planets all fell into a fiery sea during times when the gaseous layers were at their greatest. Right now, the gaseous layers of the three suns are in a contracted stage. Otherwise, our planet would have already fallen into one of them the last time they skimmed past. But scholars predict that the next expansion will occur in 1,000 years.
We can't stay in this terrible place anymore, Einstein said, crouched down on the ground like an old beggar. The Secretary General nodded.
We can't stay here any longer. The only path left for Trisolaran civilization is to gamble with the universe.
How? Wong asked.
We must leave the Trisolaran stellar system and fly into the wide open sea of stars. We must find in the galaxy a new world to emigrate to.
Wong heard a grinding noise. He saw that the giant weight of the pendulum was being pulled up by a thin cable whose other end was attached to an elevated winch. As it rose to its highest point, a great waning crescent moon descended slowly in the sky behind it. The Secretary General solemnly announced,
"Start the pendulum."
The elevated winch released the cable tied to the pendulum, and the weight noiselessly fell along a smooth arc. Initially, it fell slowly, but then it accelerated, reaching maximum speed at the bottom of the arc. As it sliced through the air, the sound of the wind was deep and resonant. By the time the noise disappeared, the pendulum had followed the arc to its highest point on the other side, and after pausing for a moment, began its backward swing. Wong felt the great force generated by the movement of the pendulum, as though the ground was shaken by its swings. Unlike a pendulum in the real world, this giant pendulum's period was not stable, but changed constantly. This was due to the continually shifting gravitational attraction of the giant moon. When the giant moon was on this side of the planet, its gravity partially canceled out the gravity of the planet, causing the pendulum to lose weight. When it was on the other side of the planet, its gravity was added to the gravity of the planet, causing the pendulum's weight to increase, almost to the level it would have had before the Great Rip. As he gazed up at the awe-inspiring swings of the Trisolaran Pendulum Monument, Wong asked himself,
"Does it represent the yearning for order or the surrender to chaos?"
Wong also thought of the pendulum as a gigantic metal fist, swinging eternally against the unfeeling universe, noiselessly shouting out Trisolaran civilization's indomitable battle cry. As Wong Miao's eyes blurred with tears, he saw a line of text appear against the background of the swinging pendulum. 451 years later, Civilization 192 was destroyed by the fiery flames of twin suns appearing together. It had reached the Atomic Age and the Information Age. Civilization 192 was a milestone in Trisolaran civilization. It finally proved that the three-body problem had no solution. It gave up the useless effort that had already lasted through 191 cycles and set the course for future civilizations. Thus, the goal of three-body has changed. The new goal is head for the stars. Find a new home. We invite you to log on again. After logging out of three-body, Wong felt exhausted, the same way he did after each previous session. But this time, he only rested half an hour before logging in again. This time, against the pitch-black background, an unexpected line of text appeared.
"The situation is urgent. The three-body servers are about to be shut down. Please log on freely during the remaining time. Three-body will now go directly to the final scene."
20. Three-body Expedition. The chilly dawn revealed a bare landscape. There was no pyramid, no United Nations headquarters, no sign of the Pendulum Monument. Only a dark desert extended to the horizon, just as Wong had seen the first time he had logged in. But Wong soon realized that he was wrong. What he thought were numerous stones arrayed across the desert were not stones at all, but human heads. The ground was filled with a densely packed crowd. From where he stood on a small hill, Wong could see no end to the sea of people. He estimated the number of individuals within his view alone to be in the hundreds of millions. All the Trisolarans on the planet were probably gathered here. The silence of hundreds of millions created a suffocating sense of strangeness.
What are they waiting for?
Wong looked around and noticed everyone was gazing up at the sky. Wong lifted his face and found the starry sky had been transformed to an astonishing sight. The stars were arrayed in a square formation. However, Wong soon realized that the stars in the formation were in a synchronous orbit above the planet, moving together against the dimmer, more distant background of the Milky Way. The stars in the formation closest to the direction of dawn were also the brightest, shining with a silver light that cast shadows on the ground. The brightness decreased as one moved away from that edge. Wong counted more than 30 stars along each edge of the formation, which meant a total of more than 1,000 stars. The slow movement of the obviously artificial formation against the starry universe exuded a solemn power. A man standing next to him nudged him lightly and spoke in a low voice.
"Ah, oh, Great Copernicus, why have you come so late? 3 cycles of civilization have passed, and you've missed many great enterprises."
"What is that?"
Wong asked, pointing at the formation in the sky.
"The Trisolaran Interstellar Fleet. It's about to begin its expedition."
"Trisolaran civilization has already achieved the capacity for interstellar flight?"
"Yes. All those magnificent ships can reach 1/10 the speed of light."
"That is a great accomplishment, as far as I understand it. But it still seems too slow for interstellar flight."
"The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. The key is finding the right target."
"What's the fleet's destination?"
"A star with planets about 4 light years away. The closest star to the Trisolaran system."
Wong was surprised.
"The closest star to us is also about 4 light years away."
"You?"
"The Earth."
"Oh, that's not very surprising. In most regions of the Milky Way, the distribution of stars is fairly even. It's the result of star clusters acting under the influence of gravity. The distance between most stars is between 3 and 6 light years."
A loud, joyous cry erupted from the crowd. Wong looked up and saw that every star in the square formation was rapidly growing brighter. This was due to the light emitted by the ships themselves. Their combined illumination soon overwhelmed the dawn, and 1,000 stars became 1,000 little suns. Trisolaris was bathed in glorious daylight, and the crowd raised their hands and formed an endless prairie of uplifted arms. The Trisolaran fleet began to accelerate, solemnly gliding across the dome of the sky, skimming past the giant just-risen moon's tip, casting a dim blue glow against the moon's mountains and plains. The joyous cry subsided. The people of Trisolaris mutely gazed as their hope gradually shrunk in the western sky. They would not know the outcome of the launch in their lifetimes, but 400 or 500 years from now, their descendants would receive the news from a new world, the beginning of a new life for Trisolaran civilization. Wong stood with them, silently gazing, until the phalanx of 1,000 stars shrank into a single star, and until that star disappeared in the western night sky. Then the following text appeared. "The Trisolaran expedition to the new world has begun. The fleet is still in flight. 3 body is over. When you have returned to the real world, if you remain true to the promise you've made, please attend the meetup of the Earth Trisolaris organization. The address will be in the follow-up email you receive." Part 3. Sunset for Humanity. 21. Rebels of Earth. There were many more attendees this time than at the last 3-body meetup. They met at the employee cafeteria of a chemical plant. The factory had already been moved elsewhere, and the interior of the building, which was about to be demolished, was worn out but spacious. About 300 people were gathered here, and Wong Miao noticed many familiar faces, celebrities and elites of various fields, famous scientists, writers, politicians, and so on. The first thing to attract Wong's attention was the strange device at the center of the cafeteria. Three silver spheres, each slightly smaller than a bowling ball, hovered and swirled over a metal base. Wong guessed the device was probably based on magnetic levitation. The orbits of the three spheres were completely random, a real-life version of the three-body problem. The others didn't pay much attention to the artistic portrayal of the three-body problem. Instead, they focused on Pan Han, who was standing on top of a broken table in the middle of the cafeteria.
"Did you murder Comrade Shen Yufei?"
a man asked.
"Yes," Pan said, perfectly calm. "It's because the Adventists have traitors like her in our midst that the organization faces the crisis it does today."
"Who gave you the right to kill?"
"I did it out of a sense of duty to the organization."
"Duty? I think you've always had malice in your heart."
"What do you mean by that?"
"What has the Environment Branch done under your leadership? Your charge is to exploit and create environmental problems to make the population loathe science and modern industry. But in reality, you've only used our Lord's technology and predictions to gain riches and fame for yourself."
"Do you think I became famous for myself? To my eyes, the entire human race is a pile of garbage. Why would I care what they think? But if I'm not famous, how do I direct and channel their thinking?"
"You always pick the easy tasks. What you've done could have been better accomplished by regular environmentalists. They're more sincere and passionate than you, and with just a little guidance, we could easily take advantage of their actions. Your Environment Branch should be creating environmental disasters and then exploiting them. For example, disseminating poison in reservoirs, leaking toxic waste from chemical plants. Have you done any of those? No, not a single one."
"We had devised numerous programs and plans, but the commander vetoed them all. Anyway, such acts would have been stupid, at least until recently. The Biology and Medicine Branch once created a catastrophe from the overuse of antibiotics, but that was soon detected, and the rash actions of the European detachment almost drew attention to us."
"Talk about drawing attention to us. You just murdered someone."
"Listen to me, comrades. Sooner or later, it would have been unavoidable. You must already know that the governments of the world are preparing for war. In Europe and North America, they're already cracking down on the organization. Once the crackdown begins here, the redemptionists will no doubt side with the government. So our first priority is to purge the redemptionists from the organization."
"That is not within your authority."
"Of course, the commander must decide. But, comrades, I can tell you right now that the commander is an Adventist."
"Now you're just making things up. Everyone knows the scope of the commander's power. If the commander really is an Adventist, then the redemptionists would have been purged long ago."
"Maybe the commander knows something we don't. Perhaps that's what the meeting today is about."
After this, the crowd's attention turned away from Pan Han to the crisis before them. A famous scientist who had won the Turing Award jumped onto the table and began to speak.
"The time for talk is over. Comrades, what should be our next step?"
"Start a global rebellion!"
"Then we're asking to be killed!"
"Long live the spirit of Trisolaris. We shall persevere like the stubborn grass that resprouts after every wildfire."
"A rebellion will finally reveal our existence to the world. As long as we have an appropriate plan of action, I'm sure many people will support us."
This last remark came from Pan Han, and many applauded. Someone yelled,
"The commander is here!"
The crowd parted to form a path. Wong looked up and felt dizzy. The world turned white and black in his eyes, and the only spot of color was the person who had just appeared. Surrounded by a group of young bodyguards, the commander-in-chief of the Earth Trisolaris Rebels, Yawinsia, walked steadily into the crowd. Yaw stood in the middle of the space the crowd cleared for, raised a bony fist, and, with a resolve and strength that Wong could not believe she possessed, said,
"Eliminate human tyranny!"
The crowd responded in a way that had clearly been rehearsed countless times.
"The world belongs to Trisolaris."
"Hello, comrades,"
Yaw said. Her voice returned to the gentleness that Wong knew. It was only now that he could be sure that it was really her.
"I haven't been well lately, and haven't spent much time with all of you. But now the situation is urgent, and I know everyone is under a great deal of pressure. So I've come to see you."
"Commander, take care of yourself,"
someone in the crowd said. Wong could hear the heartfelt concern. Yaw said,
"Before we move on to more important matters, let's take care of one small detail. Pan Han."
She kept her eyes on the crowd even as she called his name.
"Here, Commander."
Pan emerged from the crowd. Earlier he had tried to lose himself in the throng. He appeared calm, but the terror in his heart was obvious. The commander had not called him comrade, a bad sign.
"You committed a severe violation of the organization's rules."
Yaw spoke without looking at Pan. Her voice remained kind, as though talking to a child who had been naughty.
"Commander, the organization is facing a crisis of survival. If we don't take decisive measures and cleanse the traitors and enemies within, we will lose everything."
Yaw looked up at Pan, her eyes affectionate, but his breath stopped for a few seconds.
"The ultimate goal and ideal of the ETO is to lose everything. Everything that now belongs to the human race, including us."
"Then you must be an Adventist, Commander. Please openly declare this to be true, because it's very important. Am I right, comrades? Very important!"
He shouted and waved an arm as he looked around, but the crowd remained mute.
"This request is not yours to make. You have seriously violated our code of conduct. If you want to make an appeal, now is the time. Otherwise, you must bear the responsibility."
Yaw spoke slowly, enunciating every word, as though afraid the child she was teaching had trouble understanding.
"I went intending to eliminate Wei Cheng, that math prodigy. The decision was made by Comrade Evans and ratified by the committee unanimously. If he really succeeds in creating a mathematical model of the three-body problem that gives a complete solution, our Lord will not come, and the great enterprise of Trisolaris on Earth will be ruined. I only shot at Shen Yufei since she shot at me first. I was acting in self-defense."
Yaw nodded.
"Let us believe you. This is, after all, not the most important issue. I hope we can continue to trust you. Now, please repeat the request you made to me just now."
Pan was stunned for a second. That she had moved on didn't seem to relax him.
"I ask that you openly declare yourself to be an Adventist. After all, the action plan of the Adventists is also your ideal."
"Then repeat the plan of action."
"Human society can no longer rely on its own power to solve its problems. It can also no longer rely on its own power to restrain its madness.
Therefore, we ask our Lord to come to this world and with its power forcefully watch over us and transform us so as to create a brand new, perfect human civilization.
Are the Adventists loyal believers in this plan?
Of course! Commander, please, do not believe false rumors.
It's not a false rumor!
A man shouted. He made his way to the front.
I'm Raphael, from Israel. 3 years ago, my 14-year-old son died in an accident. I had his kidney donated to a Palestinian girl suffering kidney failure as an expression of my hope that the two peoples could live together in peace. For this ideal, I was willing to give my life. Many, many Israelis and Palestinians sincerely strove toward the same goal by my side. But all this was useless. Our home remained trapped in the quagmire of cycles of vengeance.
Eventually, I lost hope in the human race and joined the ETO. Desperation turned me from a pacifist into an extremist. Also, probably because I donated so much money to the organization, I became a core member of the Adventists. Let me tell you now, the Adventists have their own secret agenda. And it is this. The human race is an evil species. Human civilization has committed unforgivable crimes against the Earth and must be punished. The ultimate goal of the Adventists is to ask our Lord to carry out this divine punishment. The destruction of all humankind.
The real program of the Adventists is already an open secret,
someone shouted.
But what you don't know is that this was not a program they evolved into. It was the goal set out at the very beginning. It's been the lifelong dream of Mike Evans, the mastermind behind the Adventists. He lied to the organization and fooled everyone, including the commander. Evans has been working toward this goal from the very start. He turned the Adventists into a kingdom of terror, populated by extreme environmentalists and madmen who hated the human race.
I didn't know Evans's real thoughts until much later, Yeah said. Still, I tried to patch over the differences to allow the ETO to remain whole, but some of the other acts committed by Adventists lately have made the effort impossible.
Pawn said, Commander, the Adventists are the core of ETO. Without us, there is no Earth Trisolaris movement.
But this is no excuse for you to monopolize all communications between our Lord and the organization.
We built the second Red Coast base. Of course we should operate it.
The Adventists took advantage of this and committed an unforgivable betrayal of the organization. You intercepted the messages from our Lord to the organization and passed on only a small portion of them, even those you distorted. Also, through the second Red Coast base, you sent a large amount of information to our Lord without the organization's approval.
Silence descended over the meeting like a monstrous thing. Wong's scalp began to tingle. Pan did not answer. His expression became cold, as if to say, finally, it has happened.
There is much evidence of the Adventists' betrayal. Comrade Shen Yufei was one of the witnesses. Though she belonged to the core group of Adventists, in her heart she remained a resolute redemptionist. You only discovered this recently, and she already knew too much. When Evan sent you, he wanted you to kill two people, not one.
Pawn looked around, apparently reassessing the situation. His gesture didn't go unnoticed by Yeh.
You can see that most people attending this meeting are comrades from the Redemptionist faction. I trust that the few Adventists who are here will stand on the side of the organization. But men like Evans and you
can no longer be saved. To protect the program and ideals of the ETO, we must completely solve the problem of the Adventists."
Silence returned. A few moments later, one of the bodyguards near Yeah, a young woman, smiled. She walked toward Pon Han casually. Pon's face changed. He stuck a hand inside the lapel of his jacket, but the young woman dashed quicker than the eye could follow. Before anyone could react, she wrapped one of her slender arms around Pon's neck, placed her other hand on top of his head, and by applying her unexpected strength at just the right angle, she twisted Pon's head 180 degrees with practiced ease. The cracks from his cervical vertebrae breaking stood out against the complete silence. The young woman's hands immediately let go, as though Pon's head was too hot. Pon fell to the ground, and the gun that had killed Shen Yufei slid under the table. His body still spasmed, and his eyes remained open, his tongue sticking out. But his head no longer moved, as though it were never a part of the rest of his body. Several men came and dragged him away, the blood oozing from his mouth, leaving a long trail.
"Ah, Xiao Wong, you're here too. How have you been?"
Ya's gaze fell on Wong Miao. She smiled kindly at him and nodded. Then she turned to the others.
"This is Professor Wong, a member of the Chinese Academy of Sciences, and my friend. He researches nanomaterials. This is the first technology our Lord wishes to extinguish from the earth."
No one looked at Wong, and Wong had no strength to express himself in any way. He had to pull at the sleeve of the man next to him so that he wouldn't fall, but the man lightly brushed his hand away.
"Xiao Wong, why don't I continue to tell you the story of Red Coast from the last time? All the comrades here can listen to. This is not a waste of time. In this extraordinary moment, it is a fine time to review the history of our organization."
"Red Coast? You weren't done?"
Wong asked foolishly. Yeah slowly approached the three-body model, seemingly absorbed by the swirling silver spheres. Through the broken window, the setting sun's light fell on the model, and the flying spheres intermittently reflected the light onto the rebel commander, like sparks from a bonfire.
"No, I've only just started,"
Yeah said softly. 22. Red Coast 5. Since she had entered Red Coast Base, Yao Wenxia had never thought of leaving. After she learned the real purpose of the Red Coast Project, top-secret information that even many mid-level cadres at the base didn't know, she cut off her spiritual connection to the outside world and devoted herself to her work. Thereafter, she became even more deeply embedded in the technical core of Red Coast and began to take on more important research topics. Commissar Lei never forgot that it was Chief Yang who first trusted Ye, but Lei was happy to assign important topics to her. Given Ye's status, she had no rights to the results of her research, and Lei, who had studied astrophysics, was a political officer who was also an intellectual, rare at the time. Thus, he could take credit for all of Ye's research results and papers, and cast himself as an exemplary political officer with both technical acumen and revolutionary zeal. The Red Coast Project had initially requisitioned Ye because of a paper on an attempted mathematical model of the sun she had published in the Journal of Astrophysics as a graduate student. Compared to the Earth, the sun was a far simpler physical system, made almost entirely of hydrogen and helium. Though its physical processes were violent, they were relatively straightforward, only fusing hydrogen into helium. Thus, it was likely that a mathematical model of the sun could describe it rather precisely. The paper was basic, but Lei and Yang saw in it a hope for a solution to a technical difficulty faced by the Red Coast monitoring system. Solar outages, a common problem in satellite communications, had always plagued the Red Coast monitoring operations. When the Earth, an artificial satellite, and the Sun are in a straight line, the line of sight from the ground-based antenna to the satellite will have the Sun as its background. The Sun is a giant source of electromagnetic radiation, and, as a result, satellite transmissions to the ground will be overwhelmed by interference from the solar radiation. This problem could not be completely solved, even in the 21st century. The interference that Red Coast had to deal with was similar, but the source of interference, the Sun, was between the source of the transmission, outer space, and the ground-based receiver. Compared to communication satellites, the solar outages suffered by Red Coast were more frequent and more severe. Red Coast base, as constructed, was also much more modest than its original design, such that the transmission and monitoring systems shared the same antenna. This made the times available for monitoring even more precious, and solar outages even more of a problem. Lei and Yong's idea for eliminating interference was very simple. Ascertain the frequency spectrum and characteristics of solar radiation in the monitored range, and then filter it out digitally. Both of them were technical, and at that time, when the ignorant often led the knowledgeable, that was a rare bit of fortune. But Yong wasn't a specialist in astrophysics, and Lei had taken the path of becoming a political officer, which prevented him from accruing in-depth technical know-how. In reality, electromagnetic radiation from the Sun is only stable within the limited range from near ultraviolet to mid-infrared, including visible light. In other ranges, the radiation is quite volatile and unpredictable. To set the right expectations, Ye made it clear in her first research report that during periods of intense solar activity, sunspots, solar flares, coronal mass ejections, and so on, it was impossible to eliminate solar interference. Thus, her research target was limited to radiation within the frequency ranges monitored by Red Coast during periods of normal solar activity. Research conditions at the base weren't too bad. The library could obtain foreign language materials related to the topic, including timely European and American academic journals. In those years, this was no easy feat. Ye also could use the military phone line to connect to the two groups conducting solar science research within the Chinese Academy of Sciences and obtain their observation data by fax. After half a year of study, Ye saw no glimpse of hope. She quickly discovered that within the frequency ranges monitored by Red Coast, solar radiation fluctuated unpredictably. By analyzing large amounts of observed data, Ye discovered a puzzling mystery. Sometimes, during one of the sudden fluctuations in solar radiation, the surface of the Sun was calm. Since hundreds of thousands of kilometers of solar material would absorb any shortwave and microwave radiation originating from the core of the Sun, the radiation must have come from activities on its surface. So there should have been observable surface activity when these fluctuations occurred. If there were no corresponding surface disturbances, what caused these sudden changes to the narrow frequency ranges? The more she thought about it, the more mysterious it seemed. Eventually, Ye ran out of ideas and decided to give up. In her last report, she conceded that she could not solve the problem. This shouldn't have been a big deal. The military had asked several groups within universities and the Chinese Academy of Sciences to research the same issue, and all of those efforts had failed. But Yang wanted to try one more time, relying on Ye's extraordinary talent. Lei's agenda was even simpler. He just wanted Ye's paper. The research topic was highly theoretical and would show off his expertise and skill. Now that the chaos in society was finally subsiding, the demands on cadres were also changing. There was an acute need for men like him, politically mature and academically accomplished. Of course, he would have a bright future. As to whether the problem of interference from solar outages could be solved, he didn't really care. But in the end, Ye didn't hand in her report. She thought that if the research project were terminated, the base library would stop receiving foreign language journals and other research materials, and she would no longer have access to such a rich trove of astrophysics references. So she nominally continued her research, while in reality she focused on refining her mathematical model of the sun. One night, Ya was, as usual, the only person in the cold reading room of the base library. On the long table in front of her, a pile of documents and journals were spread open. After completing a set of tedious and cumbersome matrix calculations, she blew on her hands to warm them and picked up the latest issue of the Journal of Astrophysics to take a break. As she flipped through it, a brief note about Jupiter caught her attention. Last issue, in A New, Powerful Radiation Source Within the Solar System, Dr. Harry Peterson of Mount Wilson Observatory published a set of data accidentally obtained while observing Jupiter's precession on June 12th and July 2nd, during which strong electromagnetic radiation was detected, lasting 81 seconds and 76 seconds, respectively. The data included the frequency ranges of the radiation as well as other parameters. During the radio outbursts, Peterson also observed certain changes in the Great Red Spot. This discovery drew a lot of interest from planetary scientists. In this issue, G. McKenzie's article argues that it was a sign of fusion starting within Jupiter's core. In the next issue, we will publish Inoue Kumoseki's article, which attributes the Jovian radio outbursts to a more complicated mechanism, the movements of internal metallic hydrogen plates, and gives a complete mathematical description. Yeah, clearly remembered the two dates noted in the paper. During those windows, the Red Coast monitoring system had also received strong interference from solar outages. She checked the operations diary and confirmed her memory. The times were close, but the solar outages had occurred 16 minutes and 42 seconds after the arrival of the Jovian radio outbursts on Earth. The 16 minutes and 42 seconds are critical. Yeah tried to calm her wild heartbeat and asked the librarian to contact the National Observatory to obtain the ephemeris of the Earth's and Jupiter's positions during those two time periods. She drew a big triangle on the blackboard with the Sun, the Earth, and Jupiter at the vertices. She marked the distances along the three edges and wrote down the two arrival times next to the Earth. From the distance between the Earth and Jupiter, it was easy to figure out the time it took for the radio outbursts to travel between the two. Then she calculated the time it would take the radio outbursts to go from Jupiter to the Sun, and then from the Sun to the Earth. The difference between the two was exactly 16 minutes and 42 seconds. Yeah referred to her solar structure mathematical model and tried to find a theoretical explanation. Her eyes were drawn to her description of what she called energy mirrors within the solar radiation zone. Energy produced by reaction within the solar core is initially in the form of high-energy gamma rays. The radiation zone, the region of the sun's interior that surrounds the core, absorbs these high-energy photons and re-emits them at a slightly lower energy level. After a long period of successive absorption and re-emission, a photon might take 1,000 years to leave the sun, gamma rays become X-rays, extreme, ultraviolet, ultraviolet, then, eventually, turn into visible light and other forms of radiation. Such were the known facts about the sun. But Ya's model led to a new result. As solar radiation dropped through these different frequencies on its way through the radiation zone, there were boundaries between the subzones for each type of radiation. As energy crossed each boundary, the radiation frequency stepped down a grade sharply. This was different from the traditional view that the radiation frequency lowered gradually as energy passed from the core outwards. Her calculations showed that these boundaries would reflect radiation coming from the lower frequency side, which was why she named the boundaries energy mirrors. Ya had carefully studied these membrane-like boundary surfaces suspended in the high-energy plasma ocean of the sun and discovered them to be full of wonderful properties. One of the most incredible characteristics she named gain reflectivity.
However, the characteristic was so bizarre that it was hard to confirm, and even Yeh herself didn't quite believe it was real. It seemed more likely an artifact of some error in the dizzying, complex calculations. But now Yeh made the first step in confirming her guess about the gain reflectivity of solar energy mirrors. The energy mirrors not only reflected radiation coming from the lower frequency side, but amplified it. All the mysterious sudden fluctuations within narrow frequency bands that she had observed were in fact the result of other radiation coming from space being amplified after reflecting off an energy mirror in the sun. That was why there were no observable disturbances on the surface of the sun. This time, after the Jovian radio outbursts reached the sun, they were re-emitted, as if by a mirror, after being amplified about 100 million times. The Earth received both sets of emissions, before and after the amplification, separated by 16 minutes and 42 seconds. The sun was an amplifier for radio waves. However, there was a question. The sun must be receiving electromagnetic radiation from space every second, including radio waves emitted by the Earth. Why were only some of the waves amplified? The answer was simple. In addition to the selectivity of the energy mirrors for frequencies they would reflect, the main reason was the shielding effect of the solar convection zone. The endlessly boiling convection zone, situated outside the radiation zone, was the outermost liquid layer of the sun. The radio waves coming from space must first penetrate the convection zone to reach the energy mirrors in the radiation zone, where they would be amplified and reflected back out. This meant that in order to reach the energy mirrors, the waves would have to be more powerful than a threshold value. The vast majority of Earth-based radio sources could not cross this threshold, but the Jovian radio outburst did. And Red Coast's maximum transmission power also exceeded the threshold. The problem with solar outages was not resolved, but another exciting possibility presented itself. Humans could use the sun as a super antenna, and, through it, broadcast radio waves to the universe. The radio waves would be sent with the power of the sun, hundreds of millions of times greater than the total usable transmission power on Earth. Earth civilization had a way to transmit at the level of a Kardashev Type II civilization. The next step was to compare the waveforms of the two Jovian radio outbursts with the waveforms of the solar outages received by Red Coast. If they matched, then her guess would receive further confirmation. Yeh made a request to the base leadership to contact Harry Peterson and obtain the waveform records of the two Jovian radio outbursts. This was not easy. It was difficult to find the right communication channels, and numerous bureaucracies required layers of formal paperwork. Any error could lead to her being suspected of acting as a foreign spy. So, Yeh had to wait. But there was a more direct way to prove the hypothesis. Red Coast itself could transmit radio waves directly at the sun at a power level exceeding the threshold value. Yeh again made a request to the base leadership. But she didn't dare to give her real reason. It was too fantastic, and she would have been turned down for certain. Instead, she explained that she wanted to do an experiment for her solar research. The Red Coast transmission system would be used as a solar exploration radar, whose echoes could be analyzed to obtain some information about solar radiation. Lei and Yong both had deep technical backgrounds and wouldn't have been easily fooled, but the experiment described by Yeh did have real precedence in Western solar research. In fact, her suggestion was technically easier than the radar exploration of terrestrial planets already being conducted.
"Yeh, Wincia, you're getting out of line," said Commissar Lei. "Your research should be focused on theory. Do we really need to go to so much trouble?"
Yeh begged.
"Commissar, it's possible that a big discovery will be made. Experiments are absolutely necessary. I just want to try it once, please."
Chief Yong said,
"Commissar Lei, maybe we should try once. It doesn't seem to be too difficult operationally.
Receiving the echoes after transmission would take
10-15 minutes,
Lay said. Then, Red Coast has just enough time to switch from transmission mode to monitoring mode. Lay shook his head again.
I know that it's technically and operationally feasible, but you, Chief Young, you just lack the sensitivity for this kind of thing. You want to aim a super-powerful radio beam at the Red Sun. Have you thought about the political symbolism of such an experiment?
Yang and Ye were both utterly stunned, but they did not think Lei's objection ridiculous. Just the opposite. They were horrified that they themselves had not